It's Wednesday, February 27th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 293 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 55 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
This is Julia.
This is John.
So, John, how many games are you running at Fear the Con right now?
Four.
Dan, how many do you have posted right now?
I only have, I think, two posted, but two or three more coming.
I have two posted right now. Julia, how many do you have posted?
Absolutely nothing.
So what?
Yeah, John had a great banter topic for us today, which is, what was it, John? What was the exact phrasing?
Something like, nut the f*** up and run a game.
Right, a GM.
Yeah, that was it.
So, Julia, why aren't you running any games at Fear the Con?
Because I'm not comfortable GMing strangers yet.
I'm not comfortable.
Okay. Now, here's the thing.
I'm not comfortable driving. I'm not comfortable breathing air that's not in the womb. You have to overcome things you're not comfortable with.
If you want to practice, you can run a game for us because you're not going to find anyone stranger than us.
True. I don't know. I'm pretty terrible.
All right, here's the thing. Julia, we were talking at dinner about karaoke. And Wayne's like, I'm not sure I should go to karaoke because I really can't sing. I've never been there before. And what did you say to him?
I don't remember.
So what, we could just get to make it up then. You said, Wayne, nut the f*** up and come sing.
This is true.
You may not have used those words.
Here's the difference. I've been singing since I was like four.
Okay. So this is not you.
Well, how long have you been playing pretend?
Never.
Yeah, okay.
See, everyone worries about running a game at a con, but you have to realize when you sit down at the table, everyone around the table is there to have a good time. They're not there to screw up your game because John's running a game already and so am I.
That's right.
So the people at your
table who would go out of their way to ruin you are already busy.
The people at your table want to have a good time. They will help you give them a good time.
Let me give it to you this way.
Ooh,
I sound like I'm giving a rap here in a second.
Break it down.
Let me break it down for you. I think the issue is that with my group of friends, we've spanned so many different systems. I don't actually know one well enough to run it, I feel. Other than, none. I don't feel comfortable running any of them.
You don't know how Jenga works. You can't pull things from a Jenga tower.
Well, I could do that. Okay.
If that passes for GMing with Chad, then that could pass for GMing.
Okay, I could probably run a Chad game. Easy.
You could run a game of Pathfinder, quote unquote, whereby you just look expectantly at the D20, and if things go high, they work, and if they go low, they fail.
This is true.
No one can tell the difference between that and Pathfinder.
Yeah, I guess I'm nervous about it, I guess.
Well, I mean, I was nervous the first time I ran a con game, so what did I do? I picked Skies of Glass. Nobody there could have possibly ever played that version of the system because Dan had never posted it online. The only person that knew the system besides me that was at the con was Dan. He wasn't in the game.
Well, yeah, and I bet I could probably run a Fate game, definitely. But quite honestly,
probably, definitely.
Yeah, I could probably run one. But I think it's more time for me. I don't know. I don't have time for that kind of stuff.
Is this like how you didn't have time to watch Wrath of Khan until you were 26?
Yes.
It's like 2 hours long. Make time. Make time for a wounded hand. Because it likes to heal.
It likes.
All right, let's see what's on tap. First off, I want to let you guys know that with the postcards contest, we do have a winner. We will be announcing it very soon. Right now, we're slowed up a bit because I'm trying to gather the contact information for everyone that made it to the final round. And I've got contact info for some of the winners, but not all of them. Remember, rule 10 of the contest, if you enter, the show that picked you is the one you must contact with your contact information. So be sure to get that taken care of if you're one of the final five. So we only have contact information for some of you, which means if you didn't tell the show that picked you and you don't do it real soon, you forfeit your place amongst the winners. I know there's at least one person who is in danger of having that happen. So there you go. There's your final one and only warning five. I'm giving you. Fear the Con.
Woo!
It's coming.
It is coming very soon. If you're not signed up for it, be sure to get out there, fearthecon.com. If you are coming, we look forward to seeing you there, and we are glad to hear you're telling all your friends and you're bringing them along whether they want to come or not.
Run games.
We could definitely use more GMs, whether you're running games or not. If you're looking for a place to stay, the room block is now available. Information for that at fearthecon.com. If you go to the accommodations link on the left, you'll get information on the room block. If you're coming in early for the tourism, two things on that. First off, just like last year, throughout the week of tourism, starting on April 28th, If you go to our Twitter feed, so look up Fear the Boot on Twitter, twitter.com/fearTheBoot. I will be posting updates there, letting people know where we are and what we're doing so you can catch up with us. If you would like to be kept more in the know or have us contact you or whatever, then send an email to dan@feartheboot.com. I'll actually check these. And just title it Tourism at Fear the Con or something obvious so I know what this email's about, and I'll put it in a folder or something. And let me know, number one, when you are arriving. Number two, how you are arriving. Are you coming in on a flight? If so, what flight number? Are you driving in? We might be able to help you out with rides to and from the airport. I can't promise it, but we might be able to. And then third, give me your contact information. So a cell phone number, something like that. And as we depart for various places, I'll be sure to go through that list and say, okay, well, so-and-so should have just got in town. Let's make sure that he or she knows where we're at and how to catch up with us. So send that to dan@feartheboot.com, and I'll be sure that you are in the know on that. And Julie, I've not read that private message yet, but I saw you sent me one. So you're going to be hooking me up, helping me out?
I'm trying to get us a private room at the Cardinals game against Cincinnati.
Ooh.
From
sexy.
What I know. And I know that the people who are not from here, Cincinnati is a great game to go to because St. Louis fans don't get to boo very often. And Cincinnati is definitely a team we get to boo every once in a while because one of them put our Cardinals out of a career. So it's a great game to go to.
Cueto?
Yes.
Yes.
Screw that guy.
Screw that guy. I never boo. St. Louis is the classiest sports fans in the
country. We really are. We do not boo
often.
When
Johnny Cueto steps up, we are ready to throw batteries at him like we're from Philly.
It's really funny. It's really funny to see the St. Louis fans turn that quick because the rest of the game, they're pretty quiet, and then he comes out and everybody boos. But I'm working on it. I'm still trying to get a hold of the Cardinals clubhouse to try to get us a room. But we would need 30 people. So if
we'll get 30 people.
Well, and I posted something on the forum, and I had a small amount of interest. So if anybody else could post up and let us know how many so that I know it's worth it, I guess.
This whole like nerds can't like sports things is very 1984. It's very passe.
Yes.
It's very beyond us. You can like sports if you're a nerd.
Well, I don't like sports, but I love going to a Cardinals game.
Exactly. Well,
there's just something
about
being,
the environment.
Yeah. Being in the stadium, having everyone around yelling too and cheering. It's just fun.
The greatest part about the room is free beer and food.
Yes.
I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah. I've had the privilege of being in the room.
Yeah, your ticket price will include concessions, which for anyone who knows anything about sports, that's not cheap. So
seven innings of your buddy Weiser, who in the seats would cost you $9.25 per 12 ounces.
Yeah, and if I calculated correctly, and if I'm right on it's just the room cost, it's only going to cost people like $25 for free food, beer, and
that's easily what any of us will eat in concessions. So there you go, fearthecon.com. Be sure to sign up there, and we look forward to seeing you guys come the start of May, which is not that far off now.
It's coming up on us.
All righty. Topic for today. We haven't dealt with one like this in a while here. Kind of a sensitive issue, and I'm not being facetious this time. This is not leading to a joke. This is really into a real topic. But we haven't dealt with like a really sensitive topic in a while, but there's one that's kind of been on my mind that I would like to kind of kick around on an episode. The topic that I want to talk about is disabilities in a role-playing game. Obviously, disabilities are a part of real life. There are probably many people listening to this show right now who have a disability of some kind. There are people behind the mics right now who have a disability of some kind. Role-playing, among many of the other things that it allows us to do, is it allows us to explore various themes that we may or may not encounter in real life and kind of see how they play out. And I think one of the things that role-playing presents itself for in that regard is disabilities. Now, I think generally speaking, I'm going to break disabilities down two ways. So if you kind of imagine sort of a little graph here, we're going to have two things going across the top and two things going down the left side. And across the top, I'm going to loosely break disabilities down into mental and physical. So mental disabilities, it could be something like schizophrenia, a phobia, an anxiety disorder, depression, mental retardation. It could be anything that affects your ability to function on either an emotional or intellectual level. In the other column, we're going to put physical disabilities. People who have birth defects, have had amputations, are maybe missing a sense, they're blind or they're deaf. If you're listening to the show and you're deaf, I really want to hear about this, by the way. Going down the left side is disabilities you were born with versus those that you acquired. Because, and I'll develop these as we talk about the topic here, but I think each of those presents very unique role-playing challenges.
Yeah.
So let's start with this. Has anyone here ever role-played somebody who had a disability?
I have not. I've always had this character concept in the back of my mind that I wanted to do in a Pathfinder or D&D game. And I was mentioning this before we hit the mics. I've always wanted to play a fighter who had been like a high-level fighter and was right-handed and lost his right arm. So he's having to relearn everything with what was not his dominant hand, thus explaining the lower level initially starting and going through the struggles he goes through to try to figure out how to function when he's been so dependent on his right arm and it's gone.
What attracts you to that character concept?
I like the idea of the having a history, and I like, you know, struggling through the aspects of this used to be so easy for me, but now it's difficult. That sounds like kind of an interesting concept to just play through, is that idea of what was commonplace for you is now a struggle, that it's something you can still do and you can still overcome, but it's not as easy as it used to be.
I've played probably more mental. I had a character, and this was developed rather than being born with. She got almost destroyed in the Matrix. She was like a semi-hacker in the Shadowrun, and she became really scared of the Matrix because she almost got blown up by a bunch of data bombs. It was tough because the next storyline was kind of based around her, and she refused to go into the Matrix. I enjoyed playing her, but it ended up hindering the storyline quite a bit because I refused to let her go into the Matrix because, in all honesty, any person would be scared if they almost got killed by a bunch of data bombs.
You were the druid that wouldn't go into the city.
Exactly.
Ah,
I was so that. And I can't help but feel like it was sort of a kick to the balls to the GM, but you know, for almost killing me with data bombs. But I also played, well, I'm also playing, I should say, a character who has, well, and I don't know how many people play Exalted, but I I play Exalted.
Here comes 10 pages of forum posts. I played Exalted since the 90s.
Well, we're playing Exalted first edition, so we're going old school with it. And my particular character is one of the only ones who frequently dreams about her past lives. And one of them is this crazy tyrant pirate, and she will wake up and start murdering people. So I assume that's sort of a disability because she goes around killing peasants all the time. And it's kind of a mental disability.
Yeah, that's where I was going with my thread of the conversation. I have never sat down and been like, okay, I have schizophrenia or I have manic depression or whatever. I have played characters who have outrageously exaggerated swings in temperament and disposition as part of a more mythical framework. I played a dragon disciple who was part white dragon, who would respond to the slightest frustration or provocation with just blind mouth frothing rage. So I'm sure that's diagnosable, but in the context of Pathfinder, it's not really a disability. It's
I've had character. Things that have come up, but they're usually short-term things, like struggling with survivor's guilt or struggling with a horrible situation that happened is going to affect him for multiple games. But I don't think it's ever led to a long-term psychosis on any character I've ever played.
Well, I think you could still count that as a disability, even if, I mean, not all disabilities are permanent. There could be people listening to the show right now who have some form of disability, whether mental or physical or whatever, where within our lifetime a cure may be developed. And I think there's probably a lot of people listening to this who have had bouts of serious depression or anxiety or whatever, and with the help of various therapies have, I don't want to say gotten past that, because a lot of those things you never really fully get past, but you get kind of 90 some odd percent past it, to where you just kind of, you learn to live with it and cope with it, and you let that heal to some degree. But I don't think that changes the fact that when it was there in full swing, it still had a very serious impact on the way that you lived and the way that you understood the world.
Yeah, my bard character that John hates so much had a lot of that going on. When Gnarl had him kill a female character right in front of him, he went and he threw up afterwards, and he's morose for the next couple game sessions, and a lot of things like that just kind of going on in that character's head from his past. But again, all of that, I never thought of it at the time as a disability. It was more a, this is just what's growing naturally out of roleplay.
Being a bard is a disability.
Well, and I guess I never really thought about it, but I could easily play a character with asthma. I probably should do that.
That'd be amazing. I know. Julie, constitution check. But I'm sitting down in the board. Roll it. You got a one. You pass out.
Well, no, because it's exactly like you said with mental, where it's with, I mean, I have asthma, if the listeners don't know, and I played sports. I hold several records in track at my schools. So, I mean, it's manageable, but I could definitely see it being very hindering in any role-playing game.
See, in my case, I wouldn't want to take anything that I struggle with and throw that into one of my characters. Because I already have that on a daily basis. when I'm playing a character, I want it to be something either that I want to be or something I'm trying to experience. You know, I already know what depression's like. I don't want to play a depressed character. That kind of thing.
No, that's fair enough. But I think there's still this host of options that's out there. And I think part of what role-playing can do with this is it can build a lot of understanding. It can also demystify a lot of these issues. Because what I typically see in role-playing games is one of three handlings of disabilities. Either, number one, they're absolutely caricaturized and turned into cartoons. The Rifts Insanity Table is a great example of this. But you take some kind of a disability and it just becomes the most ridiculous, outlandish, bizarre sort of thing. It has no basis in terms of the organic development of your character. It is expressed in the most weird ways. The second thing I've seen is it's worked around by being turned into something too cool. For example, yeah, I got my arm cut off, or I was born without one, but I got to replace with a badass cyborg arm that's got a machine gun in it. And is
I tell Steve to do that every day.
He should.
Not get a cyborg arm.
He should get a freaking cyborg arm.
He should live in the Shadowrun universe.
Or look at an example from comic books, Daredevil. Daredevil is a blind character.
Yeah, except he totally sees.
Except he can see because he has echolocation.
Yeah, I that always baffled me about the characters. Well, we've got this blind guy who's completely blind, except he can see. And not only can he see, he can see better than you or I do.
Yeah.
It's actually advantageous to him that he's blind.
Yeah, it works out better.
Well, I think it depends on your GM, too, on how they handle the actual disability. Because I remember hearing stories amongst my group of friends, and I wasn't around when this happened, but one of the players created a Shadowrun character who had a flaw of being allergic to the sun and never said anything about it. And so, therefore, that is a disability, if you ask me, is being allergic to the sun. And the GM never really thought about it or used it against him. So I don't feel like it was necessarily a disability. So a lot of people, I feel like, play disabilities without actually playing the disability,
if
you know what I mean.
They gain the advantage.
Exactly. I
mean, one of the biggest ones I've seen are people give up an eye incredibly easily in games.
Right.
But they only give up one eye, and there's no mechanical disadvantage to it in that particular game.
I've never seen
and they
that.
Just ignore it.
I would never allow that. But like
Chad did that.
Yeah, that's where my mind went. Like, okay, Phil is playing the hacker character. Boom, he blows out two of his spinal discs. Now he's Barbara Gordon, but with that extra 50 points, he can give himself 22 intelligence and 90 ranks in hacking.
Yeah, and all like, he's going to do is sit in your damn van while it's
getting
blown up.
Now this is no longer role-playing a disability. This is
gaining the good
things from
it.
Yeah, this is taking a setting wherein your physical makeup doesn't matter, giving yourself a setback, and then giving yourself bonus points in areas where it does.
Yeah, if I were playing a character that had a disability developed during the course of a game, what I would want to get out of it is that struggle. I can't do something that I was able
to.
Yeah, I can't do something today that I could do yesterday.
Yeah, it's not making me cooler.
No.
It's a struggle.
But that's so antithetical to what RPGs are for most people.
Oh, no, and I get that.
It's usually I want to pretend I'm a wizard, and I'm totally on board with that. I've been doing it for years. But like, okay, now I'm deaf. How does that help?
Let me throw out the third approach real quick, and then I want to comment on what you guys are saying. But the third approach I've seen is disability is taken to the opposite extreme and it's used to reflect either A, evil, or B, punishment. If you are disabled, it's because the GM was mad at you or because you're a bad guy or something to that effect.
Okay, so personally to the player, not like all fat people are evil. Like, your character walks with a limp because the GM wants to smack you for slaughtering a bunch of kobold babies?
Yeah, that's one possibility. Or the other possibility is if you think throughout popular movie portrayals, who's always the guy in the movie who has the eye patch?
The pirate.
The one-armed man guy.
Who's the one that always has to sit in the wheelchair? It's almost always
the good guy.
It's always the bad guy.
Professor X is a good guy in a wheelchair, but like Jackson in Unbreakable was
disabled.
And he's
bad. Well, yeah, but look at the bone collector. The good guy was like disabled in a bed.
Right, and I'm sure
there's mixtures.
I'll grant you there are exceptions to it, but it seems like usually when you've got somebody where they've got a robot hand or missing an eye,
they're evil because they're pissed off.
Yeah,
at what
and we use that so you know they're evil. When you see the guy with the eye patch and robot hand, you know that's the bad guy.
The cyborg is a big example of that.
Yes, most of
your body has been destroyed. You're now robotic. You're evil.
Yeah.
Darth Vader.
Honestly, that in many ways is a pretty good example. And one thing I want to set here as a context discussion is I don't want this episode to come across as being preachy in that we are not attempting to deal with the actual politics or whatnot of disability. What I am trying to deal with instead is if you are interested in introducing this into your game, whether as a player or as the game master, then what are some ways in which you can do so and do it with respect? And I totally gather that there are some people, John, to your point, where they play role-playing games to escape. They play role-playing games because they want to be something more than what they are now. And so for the same reason that they'd rather play a wizard than a mundane, they're going to prefer to play somebody who has no defect to their personality or their body, as opposed to somebody who does. And I totally get that. I'm not suggesting that every game has to have some politically correct mixture of characters. But
even those people could find it more heroic for a blind guy to unravel the plot and save the kingdom than for some strapping 25-year-old golden-haired muscle man. I mean, hell, half the fun is Matlock is that he's old as shit and that he still manages to save the day.
Well, and I think that one way you can definitely play it where you're not taking advantage of the advantages is if you come out as maybe more a degenerative one. So rather than being like, oh, I don't have an arm from the get-go, but I get a plus to my intelligence or something stupid like that. You're like, okay, well, she or he or whoever your character is has this particular thing that is going to get worse over time. So therefore, you're not taking advantage of the build points or whatever you would get for being an amputee. Like, I know that's a huge thing in Shadowrun, is if you're an amputee, you get a ridiculous amount of build points for it.
Oh, yeah. And then you buy a cybernetic arm. It's better than the arm you
have. Yeah, so then,
a couple grand and you can buy that off.
Right. And so I think that if you come into it with more a degenerative thing, I think it would be, I don't know, more respectable, in my opinion, than you coming out being like, I don't have an arm, but I get all this other stuff.
I think that's reflected in fictional trope as well. There's a lot of heroes out there who are sitting on time bombs, commonly waiting to die for one reason or other, and are out to defeat an evil or redeem themselves.
Right.
I can't think of any villains from genre fiction who are dying from the outset. I can think of some heroes.
I can usually think of villains, but they're always things that it's a one story thing. It's they're not a recurring villain. It'll be just a one shot.
Yeah.
Along those lines, that'll work well for some things. But if you think about it, a character that has lived its whole life and then say loses an arm, initially they're going to be weaker than they were, but they're going to get stronger than they are right then. Because they're learning how to use.
And I get what you're saying, but you're also approaching it the same way somebody who has something degenerative would. Do you know what I'm saying? Like if somebody just comes out of the gate swinging, being like, oh,
you shouldn't be stronger because you took it.
Yes.
But it shouldn't degenerate you either if it's something that you're learning to live with.
Think about it this way. As role players, at least talking for the people sitting around this table, I know one of the things that we all enjoy is dealing with the character drama and the character struggles. That whoever your character is at the beginning of the game, if you have written a good character and the game master is running a good game, by the end of the game, this person is going to be different. They're going to have grown. They're going to mature. They're going to have experienced things that have impacted who they are. One of the stories that I think I've told before on this show is I once played a guy who was a super pro-human bigot. And by the end of the particular plot arc, one of the party members was an alien who had had an enormous impact on his life. And by the end of the story, it had forced him to really rethink a lot of his prejudices. And I had a lot of fun playing the growth of that character. I didn't set out with that goal in mind. I set out with a character who had some issues. And over time, it just so happened that this character evolved in the course of the game. Speaking for myself, I know I've at least kind of hinted at it on the air. It's kind of an open secret. I talk about it on the forums, probably more than I do the show, but I have an anxiety disorder. And when I first developed this anxiety disorder, I had my first really serious attack in the summer of 2000. I had to learn how to cope with this as a person. And I made a very conscious choice that I was not going to let this, as powerful as it was, define who I was going to become as a person. And I spent years struggling with it and coping with it and whatnot. And there are ways that that has forced me to grow as a person. But to this day, there are also ways in which I still struggle with it. It is not something that makes me cooler. It is part of who I am, but it is, and I want to call a spade here, it is a problem. There's a reason we call it a disability. It is not helpful to who I am. It is hurtful, even if I can say, and I can say with all honesty, I'm not just being Pollyanna here, I can say with all honesty that, yes, it has made me grow as a person. It has taught me things as a person. You could even argue that it has made me overall a better person than who I would have otherwise been. But it is still a problem that impacts my life. And Julia, to your point, it didn't make me more powerful. taking anxiety disorder did not give me psychic mind blasts right. of fear I can project at other people.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing with me with the asthma. I've struggled with it for my entire life, but I go to the hospital probably once a year. I still do it. Sometimes, like, I can't run.
Yeah.
It has made me stronger, maybe as a person, probably more determined than maybe an average person to do something to prove that I can do something. But it still is pretty degenerating.
The thing that got to me with the way you were describing it, though, is that it is a setback, yes, but dealing with that one aspect, generally, you get better with. And that's what I'm trying to say. Overall, it shouldn't continue to get worse. Like,
yeah, I know, and I agree with you.
But you learn how to deal with
what you have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you get better at dealing with that. That doesn't mean it's ever going to be, your lungs are not going to be stronger than the lungs of someone that doesn't have asthma, but you're going to be better at dealing with asthma than you were when you first got it.
Well, yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
And I guess what I'm saying is it's more the people who come out with characters with disabilities that don't plan on any growth as a character, whether it be good or bad or in another area.
Sure. And to your point, as you and John have both noted, a lot of people use them for the build points.
Mm-hmm.
And typically when they do, they pick a disability that will not impact what they do. If I'm in a wheelchair, it's only because I'm the hacker. I'm not the run and gun guy.
Right.
Look, for anyone who struggles with a real disability, you don't get to pick it. And you sure as hell don't get to pick one that's not going to impact your life. And I think the people that choose these superfluous sort of setbacks, not only I think are being overly gamist in their approach to an RPG, which I think right there is kind of chintzy. I mean, I guess if that's your group, then that's your group. But to me, that's not the kind of game I want to play. But on top of that, you're robbing yourself of the opportunity to experience something. If I'm going to play somebody who's an outcast, then understanding that social role, to me, is part of the joy of role-playing. If I'm going to play somebody that has a hatred that I don't have, that's a character theme I'm exploring. If I'm going to play somebody who's an orphan, I myself, my parents are both still alive and still married, okay? I don't come from a broken home. I don't come from an orphanage. And so I would want to explore that. And if I was taking the character seriously, I would probably take some time to Google around, check a few support groups, maybe even talk to some people I know who are adopted and ask them, look, what kinds of things have you gone through? And see what's in there that I can mine for a character concept.
Yeah, I would have to ask myself some serious questions if I looked at a character sheet and I had given my character certain aspects and it never comes up in game. Like if I wrote something into its backstory and I'm not doing anything with it, I have to wonder, why is that even there? Because it's not actually serving a purpose. There's no reason for it to be there. And a disability is one of the big things about that. If I wrote a character with a disability, then I want to explore that disability. Otherwise, there was no reason for me to ever put it down.
Now, taking the issue of cheesing the system off the table, do you guys have a different feeling about disabilities that occur during the course of a game as opposed to those that are made at character creation? If we assume this isn't some issue, once again, of you're losing an eye to get 10 more points to put into some other attribute.
And I know a lot of players would take it differently. Some players, if something happened to their character and it was they gained a disability during the course of the game, that character then is not the character they created and they're done with it.
I said that is a point I at least wanted to hit on. I have kind of a dual mind over this. Because on the one hand to me, especially somebody who prefers grittier games, having something bad happen to you that doesn't go away with a trip to the hospital or a good night's sleep is part of the character story. But at the same time, I have run games for people where something has happened in the game and up front by the rules that everyone agreed to, they end up losing something. I know I've told the story of how Tim lost a foot in Skies of Glass. Mm-hmm. The moment that happened, he was frustrated with that character. Nova. He did not want to play a character who was physically imperfect. Pat, and I want to represent his opinion here, he said that... Now,
I'm going to rag on Pat in a minute, but go ahead.
But he said in the forum discussion, when we were kind of hashing this topic out, that he would be pretty upset if that happened to him, because in his mind, he set out to make a character who is a certain person, who has certain strengths, certain weaknesses, certain good stuff, certain obstacles. And if an obstacle is thrown at him that he did not pick, He really sees it as like sort of a game master interference in the character he created.
I color sprayed Pat a couple weeks ago, knocked him on his butt for like 1d4 plus one rounds or something, and he was so mad.
He was so mad.
Dude, you're
going
to wake up 25 seconds later. He's like, I can't believe this. This happens to me all the time. Just take my character sheet.
This is what it means to be a paladin. Every time I play a paladin, this happens. It's like, every time.
Dude, you
this really happened?
Yes, it happened.
I'm used to this. I'm a paladin.
He challenged
always
the leader of the bandits, who was a sorcerer, who he knew was a sorcerer, to a one-on-one to settle it all. And I was like, okay, I'll do this. Level 1 paladin versus level 1 sorcerer. This is going to come down to one progression of roles. If Pat wins initiative, he wins. If he loses initiative and makes his fort save against the color spray, he wins. If he loses both the rolls, he's on his ass.
Yes.
And sure as Tuesday, he was on his butt. It kind of surprised me. Dawn and Beth were the other two in the room, and they immediately started shooting. It was like, okay, like we had all settled on terms by which there would be a pitched duel and no one would die and everyone would walk away from this. And you guys are the good guys.
And you start shooting.
As soon as the terms of the fight are satisfied, you just say, screw it, I'm unloading on them, I'm going into rage mode. It's like, okay, I have to play my NPCs, and, you know, they fight back. But I'm glad you brought up Pat before I did. And I'm sad he's not here to defend himself, but not really, because
it's
easier to make fun of someone who's gone.
I get his frustration. Yeah, I get it. I think for me...
but you fought a sorcerer.
No, and I get your point, too.
And it's not like you just stayed unconscious for the rest of your life. Well, you got up a minute later.
Personally, I think that is BS. But
what?
No. I get him being upset at is BS. I think that the obstacles that the GM throws at you, maybe not right off the bat because you literally just got done creating this character and making this backstory and yada, yada, yada. But later on down the road in a game, the obstacles are great because it creates story for your character that you may not have thought of. You know, the GM is incredibly creative. That's why he's a GM. And so they may throw something at you that you would never have thought of. And, you know, like I said, my character became scared of the Matrix. She was a hacker.
Yeah, I have to admit that I think if it was to happen to one of my characters, there would be a certain amount of struggle. But I would hope that I'd be able to take that struggle and actually turn it back to the game. Say, look, I am frustrated my character just lost something, whatever that was. But in the same way, if you were somebody listening to the show who developed a disability midway through your life, you know what it means to wake up one day and be frustrated at what you lost. Yeah. And so it seems like there's a great opportunity for character exploration there. But at the same time, I think I would want to know that it came from someplace fair. If the game master just did it to me for the sake of doing it to me, I would be pissed.
Me too.
Now, if the rules say, look, if this and this and this happen, then you can take a critical hit and lose an arm. And all above the table rolling, the game master didn't set out to do it. We make those rolls, and it'd be like, okay, you know, I would like to think I'd be able to roll with it, but I think I would fall into Pat's camp if it seemed really, really engineered. If, for example, let's go back a few editions because I need a spell I don't think exists anymore. We have a mage who walks up to me, casts blindness permanence. And
those both still exist.
Okay, I thought permanence they removed, but okay, the point being...
It may not be in 4, but it's in 3.
Okay, all right, but the point being they walk up, cast blindness, permanence, and I'm like, second level. I don't have any access to any ability to like cure this or regenerate
permanence
or whatever.
Permanence is a tough one to cast.
It is.
You can't just dump that on a whim in the middle of a fight.
Yeah, that person better be pretty strong.
You know, or something like the game master says, you go to sleep one night and you wake up and... I don't know. People are doing terrible things.
Although, actually, blindness doesn't even require permanence. If you get hit by blindness, deafness, and you fail the roll, it's indefinite. But it's pretty easily curable by a Defiant Spellcaster. So
yeah,
it inevitably never lasts very long.
I think one of the things that plays into it for me is, what do I want out of that character? We talked about this before. When we go into a game and we create a character, sometimes there's a theme we want to explore. So, you know, let's say I want to explore the theme of being an incredibly good-looking, you know, 20-something guy. I want to play John.
Yeah.
Aw.
And then in game...
I think Wayne just confessed you're attractive.
In game...
Batman Eager 2.
Yeah. Wayne and I have had a bromance for years now. This is no surprise.
Yeah. So then in game one, I get horribly disfigured. What I wanted out of that character was
it's
to explore...
No,
yeah.
I got
that. You got to be able to explore your own
Well,
themes.
And the GM should realize that too, though. As long as the GM sticks with that type of theme, you know, maybe a small imperfection that may have been annoying to your own character, but maybe not a lot of other people would have noticed.
Yeah, and that's the big thing is you go in knowing what you want to explore. I am all for strange things happening and rolling with it and horrible things happening to my characters. But if there's a theme I want to explore, I don't want that to happen, at least not early in the campaign until I've explored that concept.
I would also
if I've explored it, then it's another story.
I would also suggest using some common sense. Julia, there's an example that you put out earlier about the decker that won't deck anymore. Mm-hmm. And now it would strike me, and I don't know the character of the situation, but strike me at least with that character, you still have other skills you can fall back to.
Yes.
You can still contribute to the game. You're just an ex-decker. You won't use that skill set, but you still probably have other skills, contacts, weapons you can use. But I think you do have to use some common sense of saying, okay, I want to play somebody who's paraplegic, but this is a dungeon diving campaign.
Yeah.
You know, look, I don't mean to sound like a dick here, but Undermountain does not have wheelchair access ramps. Okay, it's just, it's an interesting
if
character.
If you are high enough level to take on Undermountain, being paralyzed should probably not be that big of a problem.
Undermountain starts at level 1.
Right. Well, it ends at level 20.
Well, yeah, but the point being, though, you ain't going down there in the first place if that's your character concept.
Well, you're not going to get very far.
You're not going to get very far.
Yeah, you're going to get to the first couple levels.
I guess you get thrown down the well entrance or whatever, and that's about as far as you're going to get. But I think you do have to look at, is a disability you've chosen, once you, whether it's physical or mental, so disruptive? And I hate to use that word because there are probably people listening to this show right now who struggle with a disability. And to be reduced to the adjective disruptive, I realize is not
necessarily
appealing. Yeah, that's a pleasant thing. But I say this once again, somebody who has a disability that's very disruptive to my life at some points.
The difference is you can choose it in a game. You can't choose it in a game.
Yeah, I can't choose it.
And so I think it is incumbent upon you to say, look, there's a theme I want to explore, but explore it in a way that is not going to stop the progress of the game, where it's going to be like, okay, this isn't just a hindrance. It's not just like we've got somebody who has episodes or we have to help overcome certain hurdles or they have to learn how to overcome them themselves. This has now become something where we can't progress because of the fact that this is a Cthulhu game where all we're doing is sitting in the libraries reading ancient tomes. None of them are in Braille, and so-and-so just had to play a blind character.
I think one thing you have to watch out for, unless everyone wants this, you don't want the entire game to revolve around one character's disability.
Yeah.
I mean, unless everyone at the table says that what I wanted to explore in this game is your disability, you want the game to be about what the game's about, not about...
You know what? Let's take this back to real life. There's not a person sitting at this table who does not either A, have a disability, or B, know someone with a disability, and in most cases, C, both. Of those people, how many want the world to revolve around their disability? In most cases, people want that to be the last thing that you think of when thinking of them.
Yeah, that's very true.
If you're dealing with a mental disability, you're proud if people don't know it. Yeah. If it's something that you function on a day-to-day basis and it doesn't come out regularly, that's something that you see as a success a lot of times.
Well, even some physical, you're like that too. Like I said, I hold records, and I'm very proud of the fact that people walk up to my high school boards and see my name up there and don't realize I have asthma.
Yeah, and actually, I've known people who have been missing like a foot or something, and they don't make that well known to everyone because they can function with the artificial feet.
Yeah, exactly. I think I agree with that. That as long as it's not disruptive to the game, and personally, mine was a vendetta, and hence why I wouldn't go into the Matrix. So I do have to admit that I was trying to prod the GM a little bit because he ticked me off. But for the most part,
scumbag Julie, won't GM.
No,
manipulates campaigns from backseat when game master agitates her.
No. I don't do it often. This particular
fine.
Person.
Fine, you won't let me play what I want. She's got no legs.
You can ask the rest of my other GMs. I don't do it very often. This particular character, I did it with. and it's Shadowrun. I knew how to shoot a gun too. I'm just as good at martial arts as I am at hacking crap. So there's many other ways I could get to what I needed.
It was halfway through this episode before I realized you were talking about the character being a Shadowrun character. Every time you kept saying the Matrix, I was thinking like the Matrix from the movies.
Oh, no. It was Shadowrun Matrix.
Like, wow,
sorry,
they were playing a Matrix role-play game. That might actually be interesting.
I thought that from the outset. I did actually want her saying that. She said, I got disabled the Matrix. And I'm like, I did have a moment of Neo there. And they're like, no, she means Shadowrun.
Yeah, well, so. She said data bomb about 2 seconds later.
So. Yeah, I don't remember any data bombs in the other Matrix.
But. I was wondering what a data bomb was.
It's not supposed to kill you. We'll just put it that way. My GM let it hurt me on the outside world, which isn't normal. Hence why I had a vendetta.
Let me give an example of a character I think was really well handled, who struggled with something like this. When I was running the Forgotten Realms campaign for my other gaming group, and for many of them, this was their first role-playing game. And for some of them, this was...
A game I still want to play, by the way.
Which I appreciate. I would love to run. But I can get it where it's not an online game where Pat's getting a while I'm trying to run.
I can get you online players who will not.
I will play it.
There you go.
I would play online.
Well, maybe if you two, I can do face-to-face. But anyway, the point here being,
we'll recruit Jordan and Miranda. That's a game. Okay. You played the original Blood Moon Gods with them. They showed up more often than you did. No, so there's no question there.
All right, but here's the point. When I was running that for that other gaming group, for many of them, this was their first game. And one of the things that I just loved about running for that group, and still do, that's just such a treat, is the fact that because they're new to role-playing, they don't know what it is they're supposed to do. They don't realize, for example, that there's archetypes they're supposed to follow and whatnot.
They're the most fun to play with.
And so this is how I ended up with a Southern Belle halfling. And one of the characters in that game was being played by my brother-in-law, Adam. And with the help of my sister, who is an elementary school teacher and also has a master's degree in childhood development and education, all this kind of stuff, and is very well versed and trained in these issues, was he designed an elf who has autism. Now, it's funny because you think elf, and to us, elf is idealized human. They are perfect in every way. Elves don't have disabilities. Certainly not mental disabilities.
Well, they have minus two con.
Okay, yeah.
That's about it.
And they don't get an extra feat.
But if, you know, you have an elf that's got a disability, it's crazy in a way that makes them badass and cool, okay? Yeah. And here was a guy who's, and it was not a joke. This character was not comedy relief. Because of the fact that he was so socially inept, there were some things he did that became unintentionally comedic. But that was not the point of the character. He sat there and talked with my sister, his wife, at some length about actually handling this issue in its correct and proper way. And he created a character who was an elf who struggled with a pretty intense form of autism where he had real trouble interpreting social cues and fitting in and things like that. And it was really neat to see that character explored. And I think it was doubly neat just because of the fact that as someone who's kind of tired of these tropes and archetypes, seeing it done through an elf was doubly funny.
Yeah.
Because now I'm trying to figure out, like, wow. So he goes back home to his elven kingdom he comes from off in the eastern woods. How are they going to react to this?
Because like the one we kicked out of the clan because he was too socially awkward came back. Surely
they knew about him before he left.
But
he got the autism from a vaccine or something.
No. Thank you, Jenny McCarthy.
That was brilliant.
But
note to all listeners, I am not a vaccine truther. Please get vaccinated. I don't want whooping cough.
We're just making fun of Jenny McCarthy.
Yes. And unfortunately, the thousands of people who agree with her.
Yeah, I know. A great scientist and theologian. But the point here being that as a game master, when I look back to my bag of tropes, you know, for on-the-fly improv sort
of
stuff.
Autistic elf is not one of them.
Bingo. Yeah, no. How the elves respond to an autistic elf is not... I know what people do, both helpful and cruel.
Cruel, yeah.
But with an elf, and within the context of their society and their highfalutin sort of way of handling everything, how do they handle one of their own who ain't quite right? And I really didn't know what to do with this character.
I would be scared.
It was really awkward, and it was kind of nervously funny, where at times we'd be like talking to like the big bad, and they'd be saying all their threatening stuff and be ready to blow up half the world. And then he'd just say something completely inappropriate and off subject, like about the way they were dressed or something. He played it well. I mean, it was good. It had some kind of compelling and comedic results at time, but that was not the point of the character. This character was not meant to be a joke. And he regularly turned to my sister and said, okay, well, what would someone like this do? How do they function? How does this sort of person work? And he was really interested in getting it right. And I think that is one of the things that you can get out of this. John, let's draw an example from your my life. We were playing Cards Against Humanity.
Yes.
And
what? Okay.
Dollar John tells a story.
Okay. Do I know about the story?
I don't think so. You know my roommate. You've met him.
Yeah.
My roommate's a guy named Steve, law school classmate, very good attorney of mine. He was born with one arm. He wears a prosthetic arm. And we were playing Cards Against Humanity. And the answer card was,
I was here for this.
Bet you can't have just one.
Yeah.
And Dan played opposable thumbs. So he just picked it up and shook his head and pulled it up and didn't even read the other ones. He was like, all right, this one wins. It's over. So that's how he handles that. And it's kind of funny. I've introduced him to some of my online gaming crews and didn't tell them for a long time that he had a prosthetic arm. And we play Counter-Strike with him, and he has the best ELO of all of us. So I tell my buddy Jason all the time, and he constantly refuses to believe me that, like, yeah, Steve just went 17-5 and he's playing with a prosthesis and you have two hands and he beat the crap out of you. And it's like, I don't believe that. That's not true. How's that even possible? I was like, I don't know how it's possible, but I can stand here and watch him do it. So it is possible.
He min-maxed a character creation.
He did. He took 10 extra points of aiming with a mouse in exchange for having a prosthetic hand. I don't know, man. I would trust Adam to do it just because I know he's a good guy, but I don't know if I would be comfortable role-playing in that fashion with, like, a parent of someone with a developmental disability or someone with a developmental disability themselves. I think I would just be too worried of hitting a nerve or coming off as caricature. Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to censor it from our storytelling tradition as if it's not worthy of discussion or as if it doesn't exist. But I think in the same way that it's nerve-wracking almost to even talk about these topics without worrying that you're going to unintentionally offend, I think that would permeate my depiction of any such character.
Yeah, and especially if the parent has had to deal with what their child has had to deal with through having it, because some people really are cruel.
Yeah, and yeah. I think certainly know the boundaries of your group. And this is really true of any controversial issue, whether you're talking about a disability, discrimination, I mean, anything that's going to possibly strike a nerve. Abuse is another example of this.
I guess
if you don't know the boundaries of the people around you, I can say for me personally, with the things that I have struggled with or the things I've watched people that I love struggle with, if somebody in a group said, I want to play a character who struggles with this, I don't think it would offend me personally as long as I saw that they were trying to take it seriously. You know, if I kind of sat down with them and said, okay, well, you know, some of the things you might want to look into is this, this, and this, or consider this, or these are the types of things that tend to be common amongst the people who struggle with that particular issue, I don't think it would offend me, because to me, role-playing, it's about expanding who you are. It's about trying to see what the world looks like through other eyes and gain some kind of sympathy for those kinds of situations. But having said that, I recognize there are people where for them, this has been such an issue that it's going to strike a nerve no matter how well you approach it. It's not a matter of you're treating it as a joke. It's a matter of they came to the gaming table to escape those realities. And the last thing they want is for you to make that a theme within their escape. For the same reason that somebody who has suffered abuse or suffered discrimination may very well be at a point in their life where they just don't want to hear that no matter how well it's done. And I completely get that. There are themes I have like that, and I believe most of us have, where we just don't want this in our role-playing game.
It's funny to me, though, Wayne and I are currently playing characters in your EOR game who basically have crippling anxiety disorders.
Yep.
And you are our GM, and you have a crippling anxiety disorder.
You
obviously do not do this to get away from that.
No, to explain what they're talking about, we're playtesting a version of Apocrisis right now, which I'm working on with Keith Curtis. And there is a subtype of one of the races that has really, really, really weak psionic abilities. And one of the balancers for that is that every so often, because of the fact they can't really control them, they might buy into an emotion or a thought that they didn't mean to go looking for. So they kind of pick up on somebody else's nightmares and whatnot. And it's only come up in play once. But, John, it's actually interesting because of the fact that I loosely based what you experienced, very loosely, on a panic attack.
Yeah, I caught that immediately. And as soon as I rolled the character and you explained what this was all going to be, I was like, okay, I'm going to have Dan's panic disorder.
The imagery was much more vivid. To explain what John saw, John went through a moment where his character woke up, couldn't breathe, couldn't move, had an event kind of like sleep paralysis, couldn't get out of it. But nonetheless, the moment by moment of you're suffocating and can't escape it, these are emotions that I can draw very well from real panic attacks. And say, like, look, for me, it may not be breathing. It might be I'm having chest pains or some other source of fear, but you can't escape it. It just keeps getting worse and worse and worse until eventually either it A, abates, or B, it breaks you. And while there is much more vivid imagery and you had the hallucinations, whatever, that which are not typical to a panic attack, the basic emotions that I was appealing to, the basic structure of the event, was very easy for me to come up with because I have a host of personal experiences that do a great job of describing this.
It's interesting that you put it that way, because for someone like John who's never had a panic attack, at least I assume he's never had
one. No, I don't have a panic disorder.
That is something he's experiencing now as you're describing it. But for someone who has had one, that could actually trigger one, since one of the big fears that feed into panic attacks
is panic attacks. The punchline of panic disorder, for anyone who's not familiar with it, is the final fear you have is the fear of the fear.
Yeah.
You become so afraid of having a panic attack that becomes the source of your panic.
And like when you read articles online about it and people are describing it, that can actually trigger it. It gets you thinking about it.
And that's something bad enough for me to read WebMD and think I have cholera at the end of it. I can't imagine if I actually had a panic disorder and it was real.
Yeah, that's something that I'll have to watch is as the games go on. If there is something about that that starts to freak me out or whatever, then we may have to back away from it. Now, at this point, it's detached enough that he's having somebody else's nightmares. It's not quite the same. And I'm not the sort of person where talking about it bothers me anyway. But I think to your point, Wayne, there certainly could be someone where this is going to turn their entertainment into a negative experience. It's not educational, or even if it is educational, that's being overshadowed by the fact that somebody at the table is genuinely upset.
And if you know that, you should probably bring it up personally with that person and be like, hey, I want to play with this. I want to play this type of character. Are you going to be offended by it? Are you going to have an issue with it?
Well, and different people get different things out of gaming, too. Not everyone wants to explore new themes like that. Some people are just there to have fun. And there's one thing when I look at a game, gaming is a hobby. Gaming is something that I do for fun. There are some concepts I don't want to explore because I know they're not fun to me. Going in creating a character, I may want to explore something I haven't explored before, but there are a lot of concepts I know I would never build into a character because I don't want to put myself in the mindset necessary to truly explore that concept.
Like playing a ranger.
Well, like Dan, you and I have both said that's something when we get into one of the reasons we don't like playing evil characters. Yeah. Is that when you get into that mindset to truly do it justice,
you have to start to buy into it a little bit.
Really, Dan? Yes. You don't like playing evil characters?
It depends on the type of evil.
But you like GMing more than you like playing.
Yeah, well, it depends on
And you have to play evil characters all the time when you GM.
Yes, but here's the difference. When I'm playing an evil character as a GM, first of all, because of the fact that the NPCs turn over fairly rapidly.
You can't assume the role very easily.
Yeah, you never get really deep in the role. But then secondly, I'm never rooting for those people. I want them to fail. When I play an evil character, I want my characters to succeed. And on top of that, in order to really understand them, I have to be kind of caught up in them all the time. And there are some characters I can play where on the alignment slider, they're evil, but it's not the sort of evil that freaks me out. Gnarl, violent, was willing to eat intelligent species, but he wasn't sitting there lying and conniving and manipulating and doing all these kinds of things that would really, to me, be more common of a human being who is rotten to the core.
Yeah, and the other big difference
and is... And so it was sort of evil that didn't feel terribly real to me. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying violence doesn't exist in the real world. Obviously it does. But it's not an exploration that was deeply disturbing to me, whereas I think if I was to play somebody where it's like, yeah, I'm the scumbag, lying, adulterating, rapey, puppy kicking, whatever, it would start to be like, okay, this is too messed up. I really don't want any part of this.
The other big difference is when you're GMing, you're also switching in and out of characters, too.
Yeah, that's what I meant with the turnover.
Yeah, let's say, you know, one minute I am the evil head of the Anheuser-Busch company. The next minute I am Blix the Goblin with a clipboard. You know, you can go from that extreme down to a funny character pretty easily.
Yeah.
So you can switch in and out.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wayne, you do change over NPCs a lot. You tend to play a lot of NPCs at one time, now that I think about it. When I GM, I tend to really only play one or maybe two NPCs at one time.
I like the idea of it being a vast world with a lot of characters you can come into. And for the beginning of the story, that gets a little difficult because I want to throw a lot of NPCs out there to set the stage. But then it's my hope that you'll latch on to certain ones, and the ones that aren't latched onto will kind of fade away.
Yeah,
and we're focused on
them. No, you did a great job of it. I'm just trying to...
I throw a lot of things at players in the first couple games with the mindset of seeing what they do and don't grab onto.
Huh. You know, this is probably another subject for another show, so I'm not going to really try and pack this. I tend to be more like John in sci-fi, but more like you in fantasy. In fantasy, I tend to run a lot of NPCs. They tend to be very colorful. In science fiction, I tend to run fewer but much deeper NPCs. I'll have to think about why that is. Maybe that's a future show subject. But in the meantime, fearthecon.com. Don't forget to get signed up. Get out there. Visit us. Believe me, you'll have a great time. And beyond that, check the show notes. See if we got any relevant links. We'll probably have links to something or other. Don't forget to get your information. And if you were one of the winners for the postcards contest, remember to get it to the show that picked you. Don't get it to me unless we picked you. And actually, the person we picked already have your information. So no worries there. And for the rest of you guys, have a great week, great games, and we will catch you next time.
See you.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.